Good afternoon. All right, I'm a little bit of a strange person who's going to talk to you this afternoon. I happen to be what they call a psychologist. And I have worked with trauma for 45 years, which includes all kinds of things like sexual abuse and rape, domestic violence, gun violence, trafficking, genocide. Trafficking is happens here in Baltimore. It's when children and or often women, usually women, are taken by somebody and they sell them for sex to other people. Happens all over the world. So it's actually, since you deal a lot with addictions and substance abuse here, it used to be that drugs and guns were the things that made the most money in the world. Well, actually, trafficking is doing better because if you sell somebody a drug and they use it, it's gone. But if you sell somebody a child or a woman, they're not gone. You can use them again. So it's making more money than things like guns and drugs. So it's a pretty brutal world out there, and you don't need me to tell you that. But I want to talk about some of the things that I have encountered in the work that I do that I think might make sense to you. And I'm going to talk about shame, and I'm going to talk about trauma. Those are two things that we often hide away inside ourselves because you don't want anybody to see them. And sometimes we try to hide them from ourselves, not just from other people. There's a quote from somebody who said this: what we can't talk about, we can never put to rest inside. And if it is not put to rest, the wounds continue to fester, often from generation to generation. So, for example, I often work with people who have had trauma in their lives. Their parents had trauma, their grandparents had trauma, and it was never talked about, and those wounds were never tended, and they'll get just passed on and on. Old wounds in our lives, old wounds that we carry, tend to leak poison into us and often to those around us. So I want to talk about trauma memories and about how we carry shame about that. Anybody who has trauma memories will tell you that the thing they want most is for them to go away. They don't want to think about them. And if they can't find a way to make them disappear, they just want to forget them. They want to hide them from themselves. So when we try to hide or forget those things, what we also know is oftentimes we have something we don't want to think about anymore and it keeps popping back in. I'm sure a lot of you know what that is like. So here's a quote from somebody who had trauma in her life. I live beside it. It's right there. It's fixed. It never changes. It's wrapped in a tough skin of memory that separates it from the present me. I want the skin to get tougher because I am afraid it will get thinner and crack and let the trauma spill out all over me and capture me again. And here's one other person. My head is filled with garbage. It's full of images and sounds and smells. I can't cut it out. It's like another skin beneath my skin, and I cannot get rid of it. I am not like you. You have one vision of life. I have two. I live a double life. So it's a very common experience for people who have had trauma in their lives, things that have been done to them or in front of them that they've seen, like violence and abuse and things like that. They try to keep it separate and push it away, and oftentimes then end up doing very damaging things to themselves in order to keep that from popping back up. So here are just some things that can cause trauma in the life. One of them is domestic violence. So you can have trauma because of being battered and beaten in a home, or you can be traumatized when you are a child and you watch somebody get battered and beaten. It doesn't have to happen to you. Violence in a neighborhood, living around gun violence, traumatizes people. Sexual abuse and rape traumatize people. Combat I've worked with a lot of vets in my life. Combat often traumatizes people. Terrible bullying, humiliation, really violent racism, trafficking, all of those things bring shame to people and traumatize. So let me just give you like three little stories. They're true stories, but these are people who have experienced trauma and shame, and they're telling you what it was like for them. So this is from somebody who lived in an inner city and who was very, very poor. We did not always live on Mango Street. It's on the other side of town. Mama and Papa told us that one day we would move into a real house that would always be ours and have running water and pipes that worked. But the house on Mango was not the way they promised at all. One day, a nun from my school passed by, and she saw me outside playing in the front. The bottom of the building was all boarded up. "Where do you live?" she asked. "There," I said, pointing to the second floor. "You live there?" she asked. "There. I lived there." I had to look. The paint was peeling, the wooden bars Papa had put in so he wouldn't fall out. "You live there." She made me feel like nothing because I lived there. And here's another one from way down south in the US. The first time I heard someone say, "They're different from us, you know, they don't value human life the way we do," I was in grade school. I heard them say, "Don't play with her. I don't want you talking to her." Me and my family, we had always been they. And I pressed my bony white trash fists into my mouth, and the rage was a good feeling. It was stronger and purer than the shame that followed it. The fear and the urge to run and hide and to deny and pretend I didn't know who I was and I didn't know what the world would do to me. I grew up poor, hated, the victim of physical and sexual violence, and I know that such suffering and shame do not ennoble, they destroy people. And one more, and this is a man reflecting back on his life in second grade and then a little later in life, who is a Native American. Betty Towell, missionary teacher, redheaded, and so ugly no one ever had a puppy crush on her, made me stay in for recess 14 days straight. "Tell me you're sorry," she said. "Sorry for what?" I asked. "Everything." One time in second grade, she gave the class a spelling test. Second grade, 7 years old. But she set me aside and gave me a test that was for junior high students. I spelled all the words right. And she crumpled up my paper and threw it away and then took it back out of the trash and made me eat it. "You'll learn respect," she said. She sent a letter home with me that told my parents to either cut my braids or keep me home from school. "Indians, Indians, Indians," she always said. In the third grade, I stood alone in a corner and faced the wall and waited for the punishment and shame to end. I am still waiting. Wally Jim, he killed himself driving his car into a pine tree. There were no traces of alcohol in his blood. He had a good job. He had a wife and 2 kids. "Why'd he do it?" asked the state trooper. All the Indians shrugged their shoulders, looked at the ground. "Don't know," we all said. But when we look in the mirror and see the history of our tribe in our own eyes and taste the failure in the tap water and shake with the old tears, we understand completely why Wally Jim drove into a tree. When we speak of shame, what are we really talking about? How is it different from guilt? You know, in this part of the world, we talk about guilt much more than we talk about shame. In other countries, it's the reverse. It's certainly not because we have less shame. We have plenty of it. Guilt means usually doing something that is considered morally wrong. So you have guilt if you do a bad deed, or you have guilt if you say a bad word, or have bad thoughts. I've chosen the action. I'm a grown-up. I'm responsible for the action, and I'm guilty. The opposite of guilt, of course, is purity or innocence. Shame, on the other hand, is much more of an emotional reaction to things, and it isn't so much about what I have done, but the self that I believe that I am. Here's how one psychologist talked about it. When we're suffering, distress is an emotion that we feel. Shame carries with it the feeling of having no dignity and of being alienated from the rest of the human race. Shame strikes deeper than distress and suffering. The wounds of suffering come at us from the outside. Shame is felt as an inner torment. And it doesn't matter whether we've been shamed by people on the outside laughing at us, or calling us names, or treating us as nothing, or we're just mocking ourselves. When we feel shame, we feel naked, defeated, defective, having no dignity and no value. In other words, we feel unutterably flawed and ruined, and we cannot be redeemed. There is no hope. So what do human beings do when they feel shame? Well, one of the things that happens when we feel shame in a circumstance is our mind and memory tend to go back to similar circumstances that made us feel the same way. And we sort of collect these memories, and they keep reinforcing the sense of shame and the beliefs that we have about ourselves. So we feel shame, and sort of the thinking is, see, I knew I was an idiot. We just keep repeating that script, so to speak. It confirms our old fears and beliefs about ourselves. So here are some categories where people tend to feel shame, and it's like you have a file in your brain, and every time something happens, you put it in that file, so it gets really fat over the years. So one of them, one of the categories we often have shame about is our size, our strength, our skills. And so that's an area when we feel shame where we see ourselves as weak, stupid, or defective. Another area where we often feel shame is either our dependence when we shouldn't be, or our lack of independence. And so it's the place of shame when you feel powerless to do what you're expected to do. A third area is the area of competition. And that's when the shame keeps saying to you over and over again, see, you're a loser. They said you were a loser, they're right, you're a loser. The fourth is the sense of myself. And that means when I have shame, that I think I'm special, but the way that I'm special is because I'm defective. You know, most people say somebody's special because they're smart or they're nice or they're good or whatever. But with shame, the specialness is the wrongness of who I am. Another area of shame for people is the way that we look. And so the shame message is, I'm ugly, I'm deformed, I don't measure up. And six, another area of shame is having to do with our sense of our sexual self, our sexuality. So there's something wrong with me, something defective sexually. Now, it's not hard, if you think about some of these messages that we carry with shame, to see how many kinds of trauma would instill deep shame in many of us. And they sort of, it just, the shame wraps itself around us like a blanket. I'm weak, I'm stupid, I'm helpless, I'm defective. And those feelings of shame and those messages we give ourselves start to bundle over time in these files and become deeply habituated. And they tell us who we are, and we believe them. So well, I want to look at something that someone has called the compass of shame. There? Where is it? Oh, okay. That's fine. I just didn't want to be in the front of it. And these are the different ways that human beings manage shame. So I want to just walk you through them. So the first one is at the north of the compass. People deal with shame by withdrawal, which means hiding from others, living in fear of being exposed, doing anything not to be seen. It's a place of alienation. We feel ashamed of the self that we are, and we feel very alone there. But we really don't want anybody to see us, even though we don't want to be alone. The east part of the compass is there are people who feel a lot of shame, and instead of withdrawing, they attack the self. So we put ourselves down, often in the presence of others. Well, you know how stupid I am, that kind of thing. So in a way, we stay connected where the person who withdraws does not, but we stay connected by pointing out our own flaws. And oftentimes, people who work this way with the shame connect themselves to people who are abusive to them. So, for example, a woman who does this, who attacks the self, might end up living in her lifetime with three or four men who beat her up. And so that's her attacking of the self. She has other people do it for her. The south end of the compass is avoidance. So that's the way we try to hide the feelings of shame from ourselves. We can do that with alcohol, we can do that with drugs, we can do that with other addictions. And so those are things that we take that are sort of an anesthesia for us so we don't feel the shame. Another way sometimes people avoid shame instead of using substances as things is that they become bigger than life. We call it sort of exhibitionist kind of thing. It's the one who, I am the big guy. I'm the rough guy. I'm the never mess with me guy. And that's how we avoid the shame. And so oftentimes I've worked with men who deal with it that way. But what I find out after a while is they are really big on the outside when they're around people, and they feel like this on the inside. And they hide it by being big. And then the last one is the west end of the compass, and that is we attack others. This is the bully. This is the one who beats people up. This is the one who preys on the vulnerable. And what they're doing is taking their shame and trying to give it to somebody else by attacking them. And so if I can make you feel little, then I feel big. So it's easy to see, if you think about these four responses to shame, that shame does a lot of damage to human beings, to the self, and to those around us. And it's not hard to see how shame can be passed from one generation to another. So you think about a family where a father is full of shame and deals with it in one of these ways. And he's got three sons. He's going to pass down that shame and the way he deals with it to those sons. So again, shame is not so much about thinking that I did something wrong. Shame says, I am wrong. Who I am is wrong. I am disordered. I am less than. I'm nothing but litter. I have no value. Now, there are different kinds of shame. And we often think of them, we think about individual shame. There's also a group shame, which when you, when I heard, told you the story about the girl on Mango Street, you know, you live there. Whoever lives there, that group is shamed. So sometimes it's where we are, the people that we're with, or whatever. And so there could be group shame and not just individual. There's also something I call inverted shame. And so here I am in Baltimore, and not so many years ago I read the book The Corner, and then watched the TV episodes of The Wire. And that those stories talk about what I call inverted shame. So it's about kids and teenagers and whatever, and they're using little children to run drugs, or they're pimping girls or whatever, and they aren't shameful about those things because that's what you do on the corner. It's the way it is. That's how you get value. But there was a place in the story where some of them were in school and they had a great teacher and he really worked with them and they did really well on a test. So he took them to a restaurant, a nice restaurant for dinner. And they were full of shame in the restaurant because nobody taught them what to do when you walk into a nice restaurant. They'd never done that before. So they felt no shame about running drugs with kids or pimping women or whatever, but they felt shame in the restaurant. And so it's like, it gets flipped. It's like somebody came along and moved all the labels. So you end up in a certain culture or life experience feeling shame about things that are actually shameful. And you feel shame, real shame about things. Instead of feeling it here, you feel it over here about things that are not shameful, but you feel defective because you don't know how to handle yourself in those situations. Another way that we use shame, a second kind, which has a lot to do with trauma, I call inflicted shame. And what that means is that the actions of somebody else pour garbage on you. It's not your garbage. It's their garbage. But once they do that, it feels like your garbage. So when I talk to people, a lot of people who have been sexually abused, let's say, or raped or something like that, they have great shame and they feel like it's their shame because the garbage got put on them. And so the shame that the person should have who did those actions ends up belonging to the person that they did it to, even though what happened is about this person, not about the one they threw the garbage on. I mean, in the example of the American Indian, you know, it says that this teacher was so ugly, nobody ever had a puppy crush on her. Well, that was a woman who was full of shame. You know, if that's a description of you, that means people have said things about you and the way you look. And what she did with this young man and the other Native Americans in the class was pour her shame all over them, and they carried it for her. So she's littering on them. Oftentimes when I work with somebody with a sexual abuse history, they carry the shame of the perpetrator on themselves, and they often will ask me the question, but why did he choose me? As if somehow being abused meant there was something about them that asked for that or wanted that or is wrong with them and defective, and that's why it happened. A third type of shame we might call the shame of deprivation. And that means that there are things that we don't have in life that human beings are supposed to have, and so we feel less than human. I've done a lot of traveling around the world in unusual places like refugee camps and Rwanda and Africa after the genocide and things like that, and seeing people who've lived through famines, and they have the shame of deprivation, that I'm not even human enough to get the necessities of life, let alone any extras. So they feel like an empty shell. There was a man who was imprisoned during World War II and treated very, very shamefully. And he talked about the shame of hunger, which is often felt by people who grew up really poor and don't have enough to eat. It is the easiest way, he said, to dehumanize another human being. Poor men and women who would be proud members of their neighborhood or their city or their country or whatever, are wandering, especially like during famine, wandering around among corpses, among people who can't even get up anymore because they don't have enough to eat. So when we don't have, again, you go back to Mango Street or something, the story there, you don't have certain basic human things, you feel shame about that as if it says something about you. I've worked with some men who've come out of prison, and so I know that a lot of them, the reentry is extremely difficult, and a lot of them feel shame because they can't make it work. They can't get a job, or they can't, you know, they don't have an education or whatever. The deprivation in their lives of things they never got. When they're trying to re-enter society after prison, they carry that tremendous shame of those things they do not have. And then the last one I want to mention is the shame of survival. Any of you who are vets, you know something about that, I'm sure. You know, oftentimes vets will come home and feel shame for having survived. And sometimes they'll think of their buddies who didn't survive and they'll say, that was the better person. He should have lived, not me. Or the other way that that happens is I talked with a sniper in Afghanistan, and he was a terrific sniper, and he would stand on the mountain, and his commander would tell him who to shoot, and he would shoot whoever they told him, and he was a good shot. But then he came home, and he says, I'm not a killer, but I'm a killer. And he can't put that together in his head, and ends up feeling tremendous shame upon returning home for the things that he did in war, which made sense there, but don't make sense here. So a lot of vets, for many reasons, suffer with different levels of shame. Shame comes to people who don't have jobs. Shame comes to people who are homeless. Shame comes to people who were a success and at the bottom completely fell out and now they don't have anything. I mean, there's all kinds of things in our lives that create shame. And it is a terrible, suffocating burden to carry. All right, let me just say to you a couple things also about another way that we respond to shame besides the compass. And this has to do often with shame that's rooted in trauma. When we have trauma, our brain and our body responds in one of three ways. One is to fight, one is to flee, and one is to freeze. And so when people come at us in ways that are shaming, we have those same immediate reactions. Some of us put our fists up and give it back. Some of us run away, which could be literally, of course, or it can just be into ourselves and not facing and talking about what's happened, or it can be fleeing into things like drugs and things like that. We want to be rid of the shame, and we don't want people to see who we think we are. Now, I want to talk to you more specifically about the trauma of sexual abuse and how that brings shame. It's a difficult topic. Most people are very uncomfortable with it. It leads to a lot of shame, but it's also possible to find healing for it. But I want to give you some facts about sexual abuse among males in this country. When I first started out as a psychologist, nobody talked about sexual abuse at all, about for anybody. And then they started talking about it for girls and women. And they left out the men and the boys. And that's beginning to change over the last 15, 10 years or so, I'm finding. And the statistics are really quite stunning. Because one of the things I know from male and female abuse survivors is they think they're alone. They don't really know how much it happens because nobody talks about it. So I just want you to hear what's going on in the United States in this area, and I suspect for some of you is part of your story. Sexual assault is the fastest growing crime in the United States, which means it's ahead of opioids. Someone in the United States is sexually assaulted or abused every 90 seconds. Childhood sexual abuse occurs in 1 in 4 females and 1 in 6 males before the age of 18. So you think about that. One in six. One, two, three, four, five, six. One, two, three, four, five, six. Just statistically, some of you have experienced this. Also, as I've said, people don't talk about it, so there are many factors, one of them is shame, that lead to people not ever saying anything. So one in six isn't really right. One in six is only what we know so far. The average age for sexual abuse to begin is 6 for girls and 10 for boys. The majority of abusers of both males and females are males. However, there's a 3 to 7% are female abusers. However, there's been a lot more in the news in the last 5 or 7 years about females who have been abusive, like high school teachers with adolescent boys and things like that. So I don't think that statistic is correct. I think there are more female sex offenders than we know. I've worked with many men who have been sexually abused, some by men, some by women, some by both. Most abusers are considerably older than the victim, but there is in the United States a troubling increase in younger perpetrators. So law enforcement officials are saying that in recent years, 33% of those arrested for sex crimes have been under the age of 18. Male rape occurs all over the world. Boys are raped by the bigger and stronger. Boys are trafficked. We know about military sexual assault. I've spoken on some air bases about that. My daddy was a colonel in the Air Force, so I have been asked to go and speak on that. It's happening to many men. Rape in prisons is prolific. And rape during war. All of those have male victims. There was an article in the American Medical Association Journal that said boys born in poverty and raised in homes without a father are at a far greater risk for rape. By the age of 12, the rate of using alcohol, cocaine, marijuana, and IV drugs was 25 to 50 times higher for 12-year-old boys who had been raped than for boys who had not. 25 to 50 times higher. Abused boys have 12 times the normal rate for suicide. And abused boys go on to have higher rates of mental illness than males in the general population. There's been recent research about men who are in and out of homeless shelters multiple times that suggests a 40 to 60% rate of a history of sexual abuse. Research shows that male prisoners have been assaulted prior to prison at staggering rates. There was a study of prisons up and down the East Coast, and the rates were close to 90%. Not in prison, before prison. Prisons, homeless shelters, and rehab centers show an elevated number in terms of the history of sexual abuse. And I know that the silence that surrounds the abuse of boys and men in our culture has caused a tremendous amount of suffering, and it's suffering that is done alone. One out of every 10 rape victims in the United States is male. Males, and this is an interesting one, 18 to 24 and in college. So that's a privileged group, right? Those guys are 5 times more likely to be raped than those in the general population. 44% of the victims of sexual abuse are under 18. And 93% know their attacker, not a stranger. Victims of rape, both male and female, are 3 times more likely to be depressed, 13 times more likely to abuse alcohol, 26 more times likely to abuse drugs, and four times more likely to experience mental illness. So, boys are raped by the bigger and the stronger and don't talk about it. Instead, they carry it silently with a huge burden of shame, the feeling of something is wrong with me because of what happened. But wounds that are not tended don't heal. You know, if you bust your leg and you don't take care of the wound, it can get infected. And if you really don't take care of the wound, you could lose the leg. Wounds that are untended fester and make poisons in the rest of our body. Abuse causes anxiety and depression, physical problems, interpersonal difficulties. They shape our meaning in life. They shape our identity. They lead to shame. And if you had any faith, it often shatters it. Abuse is never no big deal. Abuse is not just forget it and it'll go away. Abuse is life-altering. So let me tell you a little bit about healing. The traumas of sexual abuse and rape, and other traumas as well, begin to heal when somebody listens as you tell your story. The one thing that you really don't want to do, of course. And they respond to you in the ways that are opposite to the way the abuser was. So they respond and you matter. They respond with respect. They respond affirming your courage and telling your story. It's the opposite of what happened to you. And recovery from trauma, any kind of trauma that you can think of, requires three things, and they're pretty basic things for humans. One is talking, one is tears, and one is time. And you have to have all three. You can't recover from trauma, whether it's war trauma or rape trauma or anything else, unless you tell your story. It won't get better. You stay stuck in the past and controlled by the trauma, either because you're using up a tremendous amount of energy trying to make it go away, or because it controls your feelings, your sleep, your relationships, and everything else. And it has to be spoken in a safe place with a safe person over and over again for a while. Second, trauma recovery needs tears. And by that I mean we need to grieve. Anybody who's experienced trauma has lost the self that they were before that. You talk to any vet, they lost the self they were before they went. They aren't going to ever have that person back. And there's grief involved in that. The tears honor the victim. They honor the awfulness of what occurred. They express those emotions that we shut down that haunt our sleep and make nightmares. They honor those that we lost because of paths we've chosen or whatever as a result of the trauma. Trauma's worth crying over. Tears are a way of remembering and expressing the things inside that we've never given words to. And it's a way of gaining mastery. Because you see, when you tell your story, in the talking and in the tears, the grieving, basically what a victim is doing is standing like this and staring the darn trauma in the face and saying, "You will not run my life. I will talk about you. And I will express how I feel. And I will give words to the damage that you did to me. You do not own me, and I'm not going to let you own me." That's what talking and tears do. I will tell you what you have done to me. I will tell you about the pain that you've caused in my life. I will remember what I lost. And I will be in charge of my story, not you. And I will give it the space and honor it is due. It mattered then what you did to me, and it matters now. And the third thing is time. All healing requires time. We don't really like that, because when we're in pain, we want it done now. And you can't speed up time. You can't say, "Okay, I'll tell the story really quick and get it over with, and then I'll have some emotions, and then it'll be all done." Nah, doesn't work like that. It takes time. It takes time to find the words. It takes time to have the courage to say the words. It takes time for somebody to listen and understand. It takes time to express so that somebody can really understand what it was like to be you in that place. Recovery from anything takes time. You know, if you fall down the steps here and you break a bone and you go see the doctor, first of all, he has to figure out what bone. And then he has to figure out what kind of break and how it is going to heal. He needs to listen. He needs to understand what you're feeling. You're going to be in pain, and you're going to want the doctor to fix it right now. Can't do it. You want your leg to be better tomorrow. What you want will not change the pace of time. Time has to be honored in this process, even though it frustrates us. It's needed for recovery. It is not the same for every trauma survivor any more than it's the same for every broken leg. Some take longer, some have more complicated stories, and some don't take as long. There are many reasons for that, but no matter how strong somebody is, no matter how tough they are, no matter how hard they work to tell their story and express what it did to them, it will still take time. And I can tell you two things for sure about time. There's nothing we can do to make it go faster, and when we're in pain, that's exactly what we want. We do know this, both from clinical experience and the research, that when you tell the story, and you tell the truth of what it's done to you, and you wait for the time to pass, for the healing to occur, survivors of trauma end up carrying a much smaller piece of the trauma that was inflicted on them. That's not like you forget that it happened, of course. You can't make that go away. It's part of your story. But at the same time, it isn't sitting in the chair in charge. It's over here somewhere, and it's a piece of your story. It's not the thing you spend all the energy in your life trying to make go away. And over time, you get to choose what you do with your suffering. Now, some of you already know about that in other ways, because you're here, you've done hard work, been in the program, and now you're helping other guys. That's a choice you've made about what to do with some of your own suffering. The same thing is true with trauma stories. You can't erase it, but you can choose how to carry it, and you can know that it doesn't say who you are, and you can choose how to use it in a way that benefits others. Shame and abuse are very hard and dark places to go. And I think if I took a poll, including myself, that 100% of us would say, no, thank you. Nobody wants to go there. I know they're hard and dark places because I've spent 45 years listening to people tell their stories and tell me what it did to them. But I also want you to know about hope. One of the things I call the work that I do, besides being hard and dark, is that I have a front row seat to redemption. I've seen some remarkable things happen in some really shattered lives. So I want you to hear me when I say to you, it's a hard, dark place. It's also eventually a place of beauty and hope that can be shared with other people. Because in that place, when that work is being done, it's like watching chains fall off. It's like watching crippled feet run. It's like watching a stooped back stand up straight and have dignity for the first time in a life. And I want to tell you why that's so. Because in that hard, dark place that gives me a front row seat to redemption stands the person of Jesus. And he is the great and loving redeemer of all broken things. Whatever's broken in you, he can redeem. He's the great potter. He takes the busted pot and he reshapes it into something beautiful. And that redeemer is waiting for us always. He's waiting here for you today. The road's hard. Truth and light reveal all our flaws, and we would rather hide. The road is painful. The injuries done to you and by you will bring pain when they're faced And we would rather numb than look. Will you want to run? Absolutely, you will. He will not. And if you do run, he will wait for you to come back. You see, this Jesus that I know understands shame and abuse. He understands it really well. Listen to his story. This Jesus was born to an unwed mother. That was really shameful stuff back then. He was a child of Nazareth. He was from Mango Street. He was from there. It was the despised place. In his day, he walked the roads in the company of women. That was considered shameful because we're supposed to be really less than and not worth hanging out with. He touched lepers and demoniacs, and he bothered with children, which was really considered shameful because they weren't important at all. He was sold for the price of a slave. He was sold by somebody he thought was a friend for a few pieces of silver. He was pretty cheap. He was arrested by religious leaders, and he was publicly insulted and called names, and then they dragged him through the streets. It was very shameful. And then they stuck him up high, and he was naked, and they spit on him, and they pulled out his beard, and they humiliated him and made fun. And he was on one of the most shaming, torturous instruments of death that has ever existed in the history of mankind. He was shamed by the world he made. And he became shame itself and was not covered and did not hide. Now, you and I are shamed creatures. All of us. There's nobody who doesn't have shame about something. Sometimes we are shamed by our own doing, sometimes by the torment of others. But he asks his shamed creatures to look at him. He wants us to lift our eyes and look at him, humiliated, shamed, spit running down. He wants us to watch him endure pain and suffering and abuse and shame for us. Now, typically, if you have somebody like that in front of you, you probably wouldn't want to look. I mean, we don't really like to look at other people being really shamed like that either, most of the time. And he says, look, look at me and see what I'm doing. Watch me. Stare down my shame with me. And then we're told in the Bible that he despised the shame. He hated the shame. Well, we get that. We don't like it either. But he wasn't afraid of it, and it didn't make him small. He didn't curl up and hide from it. He loathed it. He abhorred it. He considered it worthless. Shame is the thing that makes us feel worthless, and he said shame is worthless, not you. And he says to us, I did not hide my face from shame and spitting. That's the very thing we want to do when we feel shame, is hide. And children know this instinctively. You know, if they've done something and they feel shamed by you and your correction, they'll hide in their room, they'll hide in the closet, whatever. We do that from the time we're little. He didn't hide. In essence, you know what he did? It says that he spit on the shame. He considered it of no value. He spit on being spit on. He diminished shame itself. Shame is one of the most diminishing things for human beings in the world. And instead of being diminished by it, he diminished the shame. He stared it in the face. He despised shame. You and I are shamed and have no glory. We have no dignity. Jesus spit on shame and sat down in glory. And it's important that you hear that he spit on the shame, not the shameful creatures who were doing this to him. He did not spit on them. He spit on the shame that they gave him. He refused to let it say who he was. He refused to let it destroy him and his work and his purpose. And that work and purpose was to love us and change us from shamed creatures into creatures with glory. You ever thought of yourself as somebody who might have glory? And we're there with him because, you see, he's bearing our stuff. The shaming we've done and the shame that we have. He carried our shame so that he could exchange it for glory and share his glory. So he took our shame and he gives us his glory. We hid our faces. We hide our faces when we feel shame. We want to hide from him. He wants us not to hide. He wants us to see him. And so here we are, a room full of shameful creatures, every one of us. And we're invited to look at this Jesus and tell our story and watch him carry our shame and let him turn us into creatures of glory. Gentlemen, you are men created in the image of God. I don't care what you've done. I don't care what's been done to you. That's still a truth, whether you can find it in yourself or not. You were literally knit together by God in your mother's womb, no matter what the circumstances of your birth were. Whether you were wanted or not, whether you were loved or not, you were knit together by him because he wants you. No matter your history, no matter how much you have shamed others, and no matter how shamed you have been, and I know for many of you in this room, the burden feels like you can't breathe. But this shamed Jesus is indeed the redeemer of all broken things, and that includes you. He knows abuse and trauma. He experienced it. He also knows your story, every detail. He understands your shame. Let me tell you a story as I close. This is about a woman who carried a tremendous amount of shame, somebody I worked with many years ago. And she had a story that included many abusers of many kinds, a lot of sexual abuse. She lived out in the country. And one of the things that was a regular in her life was being dragged by a bunch of guys into a barn and stripped and put in the middle of the circle, naked. And they would stand around the circle and say things, shaming things, and then they would gang rape her. And that happened to her over and over again. And she said to me, I don't know how to do this thing with God. Where was he? What did he think while they were doing this to me? So one day after we worked together for a long time, I said, okay, I want you to go home this week. And I want you to read this verse in the Bible. And I gave her a reference to something in the book of John. I think it's chapter 19, 23 or something. I didn't tell her what it said. I said, just read that particular verse 3 times a day. And you come back and tell me what you learned about God. And she came back to see me a week later. And I hadn't shut the door to my office yet. And she hadn't sat down yet. And I hadn't sat down yet. And she said, Diane. They took his clothes. They took his clothes. He knows. It changed her life. He knows what it's like to stand naked in front of a bunch of people who are jeering at you and who abuse you and use you. She found him
in her place of greatest shame.
Whatever yours is,
that's where he is.
He knows. He understands. She found him in the darkest place, standing with her, bearing her pain, her humiliation, her nakedness, her shame, and her fear. He knows. It is my prayer for you, gentlemen, that you will find him in your darkest place, your place of greatest shame. He's there, and he's waiting for you. Thank you.
You stop there. As the saint said, we're going to take just 5 minutes for questions. Do you guys have any questions about the language? She covered a lot of ground.
That means I have to have really quick answers.
But we're going to take just 5 minutes. So go ahead up first and run off the mic.
Thank you. My question is, if someone is sexually abused as a kid and they dealt with it through a counselor, but the pain's still there, and we talk about it, does it stab off the wound that should have been healed from the past?
That's a great question, and talking about it more will probably help more. One of the things I have found is that healing, and it's true with our bodies too, healing occurs in layers. So you might have a history of something like sexual abuse, and you might have met with a counselor and found it very helpful, and a few years later you're thinking, I need to do that again. And it doesn't mean you didn't do it right, or you didn't do it, and it doesn't mean you'll pull the scab off and make it bleed again, though it might hurt when you talk about it again, of course. But there's another layer. Maybe there's ways that you think about yourself that are still rooted in that, you're not even aware of it, or whatever. Some years ago, I had a hip replaced because of an accident and whatever. And I've never had anything like that done before, and that was one of the places I learned that healing is in layers, because there were lots of layers of skin they cut through on my leg to put that thing in. And it took a long time, and when I went back to the doctor, I said, it still feels pain. He said, it's going to take over a year for you not to feel pain, because so many layers are there that still need to heal. So that's part of the time thing. But I would encourage you to talk to somebody again that's safe and just explore and say, how is this maybe got a hook in me still?
Hello, Dr. Weber. Mustard just led me to say, just say thank you. As you got talking about Jesus, I mean, it just felt really enlightening to hear a medical professional speak like that. You don't hear it that often. I know Jesus is healed from many things. Just hearing him speak about that was extremely encouraging, and I just wanted to say thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you for telling me.
Also, thank you, Dr. I'm one of the best things I've seen Dr. Diane.
Yes, absolutely fine.
Time to share your experience and be with you. But, as you were talking, you touched on a lot of sensitive subjects. I got to mention that, you talk about being shot and being in that type of environment, but when my mind went back to those situations, it was just a normal occurrence for us at that time in that era.
Yes.
So it was almost like we did that to survive. And I never thought that it could have an impact later on in life. Because I did, I had a person that I talked to and I shared honestly about it, and he shared some stuff honestly with me about it. And I thought we kind of worked through it after we talked about it a little bit, but I didn't realize that it takes time for that healing. It takes time to heal And you know, sometimes now, I was talking to him yesterday, and as I was talking to him about some stuff, I could feel some anger rise up on the inside of me. And let me tell you this, I understand that Jesus has been saved by his grace and kept by the integrity of his love, so I understand that. So what I'm telling you about it is the war still raging on the inside. You see, I look at them situations and I always say, it was by the grace of God that he kept me through all that stuff. Because everybody didn't make it out of there. See, I know I understand that I'm here, but what I'm telling you is that everybody didn't make it here and came up with me today. You understand that? So I look at that and go, it was just by the grace of God. He did that and allowed me to go through that so he could reveal himself to me. So all that stuff, it's all right. But now, you tell me, no, 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 young man, it caused trauma. It has to be dealt with. You know, I don't have to take a lot of time, but you're touching a lot of right sensitive stuff.
Yes, I do.
And one more thing. It is good to hear a medical professional say that their hope is in Jesus Christ, because usually it's got to be intellectualized. It's got to come out of a book somewhere, you study somewhere. But now I'm talking about God and say, God is the true healer. So again, I thank you.
I want to say a couple things about what you said. Thank you. And first of all, has anybody ever told you you have a good preacher voice? I bet you could preach. But yes, you made a very important point about things that happen to us often as children in an environment where it's the only thing that there is that we see. And it's just the way life is. And so until you get someplace else and you see, it's not like that here. Everybody didn't live like I did. But you can be traumatized by things that are happening to you that you think are just normal. Because human beings were not created to live with bullets going by their heads. That's not what God made us for. We weren't made to live with all kinds of violence and things that we live with. Even if we think it's normal, it's still shaping us. Because children are being shaped by circumstances. And our brains get wired when there's violence all around us a certain way and things like that. So that's a very important thing. And part of what happens when you leave or you're someplace like this, you begin to realize that wasn't just the way it is, and it certainly wasn't the way it was supposed to be. And now I need to think about how that's affected me. And I didn't even know it had because I thought it was normal. So that's part of the layers of digging down and understanding.
It's just crazy how things work out, because I actually have a crisis on my hands right now with someone that I'm responsible for has been through trauma and mental issues, and so is their family. And one of their family members is real unstable. Like, I actually got a text this morning and reformed and had phone calls. Like, they're really unstable. It's really a bad situation. And it was almost a crisis. And it probably still is a crisis. And, like, it's not my place, because I'm not responsible for them. But I am responsible for the person that I am responsible for. And it's not my place to say this person needs help. Or this is what she... this is what that person should do. You know what I mean? And, like, the only thing I can do is be loving and caring to the person that I am responsible for.
Yes.
And, like, I just don't know how to go about, you know what I mean, dealing with the whole situation.
Well, part of what you're saying about being loving and caring for that person and telling them that you want to be there for them as much as you can, you want to direct them to people who can help them. You're willing to listen to their story, and you're not going to run away. I think, often don't realize the significance of having somebody listen to us. You know, I train counselors, and, you know, young counselors want to know, what should I say? Nothing. And they want to know that what to say, it has to be the right thing to say, and they have to be able to help them fix it. Be present to the suffering and listen. You are honoring a human being when you do that. You're treating them with dignity. It has great value, even when you don't know what to say.
Well, let's see, God, I heard one more. that is this thing.